the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we call it Just Love because just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and love yourself. And if we all do that, then our world will be more just and more compassionate. Well, it's 4th of July week, and we celebrate 4th of July, a day that gives us a chance to reflect on kind of the history of our country. And history is one of those really, really boring topics. Not so much. Sometimes we think it's boring, but that's why I'm delighted that in a few minutes we're going to have as a guest Kenneth Davis, who wrote books. I think he wanted to call them, but they wouldn't let him, History for Dummies. But instead, we're calling them What You Didn't Know About History, But What You Want to Know About History. So I'm delighted that as we kind of go to that very important historical day in our country, we're going to be studying history, and not so much studying, but we're going to be enjoying history and realizing that it's about real people and real situations, and not like those big, ugly, dull tomes that we kind of read in school, those of us who are old and ancient. And so that's what we're going to do in the first part of our show. And then, you know, because Independence Day and 4th of July does have to do with the country, and oftentimes the country needs to protect itself. And tragically, when that happens and when people go to wars, there are people who get injured and there are veterans. And so in the second part of our show, we're going to be speaking with Jaspin Booth, who is the founder of Final Salute, which tries to make life better for especially female veterans. And so in the latter part of our show, we're going to speak with Jaspin Booth. And in the beginning of the show, a little bit, we're going to speak about history and as we approach Independence Day. So, and as we do so this week, there's kind of a lot going on in the world. And, you know, Victoria, did you happen to hear that we got a new pope, 2 years old, Pope Francis, and and he got a little tired of hanging out in Rome. Did you know that?
Yes, he's ready to make his way over here.
He's coming to our hood.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, in September he's coming here and he's going to do some visiting. I'm going to talk about that in the middle of the show. You like this pope, don't you?
Yeah, I like this pope. You know, he's into this new generation, so I like that. And it's around my birthday.
It's around your birthday? When's your birthday?
911.
911. Yeah. Okay.
State of emergency. It's Vicky's birthday.
Well, it's his day, except for that bad 9/11 2001.
See, I tried to bring the good out in it.
You are the good in it. You are the good in it. So anyway, so you got to get ready for the Pope's coming because it's right after your birthday.
I will be suited and booted.
I like that. That's good. That is good. So anyway, so listen, you know what? I want to talk about history. I was almost going to be a history major in college, and then they introduced sociology, so did a little bit of history, but my major was in sociology. So, and you know what my mom always used to say about sociology?
What did she say?
She said sociology is like, you spend a lot of time studying the fact to learn that, like, after you do the big study, you learn that most people put ketchup on hamburgers.
Oh, my goodness.
And she said, you know, in the sociology, they do another big study. They learn that many people put mustard on hot dogs.
Oh, so she didn't everybody pretty much do the same thing.
Yeah, she didn't have much use for some of that stuff. So she told me I should have learned
My minor was history.
Your minor was history? Ah,
yes.
Good. So you're going to be part of our test today.
Oh.
You got to learn?
How much I remember, but we'll see.
So anyway, so let's go to Ken Davies, who is a historian, the author of Don't Know Much About book series. That's kind of the other version. It's not History for Dummies, and it's Don't Know Much About Histories. He was educated in Concordia College in Bronxville and Fordham University. Ken, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you. And I just want to say right away that I don't consider my readers dummies at all. I consider them very bright people who have and curious people who have been miseducated too often. And so this is history that's fun, interesting, entertaining, But mostly human, and that's what we lose when we talk about history in school. We get so hung up on dates and battles and speeches and court decisions that we leave out the human side of the story, and nothing is more fascinating to me than the stories of real people doing real things in real places, and that's what history really is, and then connecting it to what's going on in the world today.
Well, you know, Ken asked me a little bit earlier, like, well, you know, our radio show, Just Love, bet you don't do a lot about history. And I said, no, we do a lot about history because we believe that our religion is historical. It was founded not about an idea, but we believe that Jesus came among us, took on our humanity, and lived in history. And so what's going on in the world is absolutely critically important to kind of how we bring values to that, how we try to make the world more just and more orderly. And history is critically important because, as they kind of say, somebody says, because I'm not a historian, I don't write books, I don't got to do all the footnotes. So, but somebody once said, if you don't know history or repeat history, you're doomed to repeat it. Somebody say that?
George Santayana is the philosopher who said, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. And it's one of the most oft-repeated cliches, but probably one of the most ignored, because there's always an arrogance that people say, well, I understood what happened then, but we're going to do it differently. And very often we do not. But to the point of your connection of religion and history, it's something I write about a great deal in my books, The Don't Know Much About series, covers a lot of subjects we don't know about but should. And I try and treat it, as I said, in entertaining and informative way. So I've written Don't Know Much About History, the first book in the series, and went on to geography and the Civil War. And in reading about the Civil War, I learned something very interesting. It was the first time, at least in American history, that the Bible was used to argue two sides of the same question. Slavery, of course.
Okay.
Abolitionists were saying we have to listen to the golden rule and abide by it. Many, many Christian slaveholders pointed to the long history of and traditions of slavery in the Bible and justified it that way. So it was that, in a way, that got me started on doing Don't Know Much About the Bible. And we can't understand American history in particular without understanding the long relationship between religion for good and ill in our history. Brief example, and I know we're going to talk about Independence Day, but this goes back a long time ago. The first pilgrims to America that came to America.
1612? 19?
Well, you're thinking of the Mayflower Pilgrims.
Yeah.
I'm going back much further.
Well, they weren't called pilgrims, were they?
They were French Huguenots.
Oh, but they were small peas.
And they were Protestants and came to America for exactly the same reasons the pilgrims sailed about 50 years later.
Okay.
They had the wisdom to settle in Florida in June rather than going to Massachusetts in December.
Okay.
But that was a good idea. King Philip of Spain didn't like the fact that these French Protestants were hanging out on what he considered his territory in Florida.
Get off my turf.
Basically. And that's why he sent an admiral over to essentially wipe them out. And this was the massacre of Fort Caroline, which is near Jacksonville, Florida.
Ah.
And this is the reason that St. Augustine was established. It was established as a beachhead for the Spanish fleet that came over to remove these Protestants.
Okay, so now I've got to ask you a historical question. You said the Huguenots were Protestants. So where'd the term Protestant come from?
Well, of course, the idea comes from the essential idea that they were protesting against many of the traditions and rites and liturgy of and rituals of the Roman Catholic Church.
Wrong.
Okay,
wrong.
Give it to me.
It was Calvin and Zwingli's protest that Luther didn't go far enough in breaking from Rome. That's why they were called the Reformers.
See, I believe that if I don't learn something every day, it's a wasted day. So now I've learned something.
See, and you know that Luther never really thought he left the Catholic Church.
It's interesting also because these French Huguenots, Protestants, were called by the Spanish Lutheranos, Lutherans, and there is a place near St. Augustine called Fort Matanzas, by the way, which is a Spanish word for slaughters, where about 300 Frenchmen were put to death, not because they were French, but because they were Protestant. And this is such an important part of our American history, and we tend to overlook it because it doesn't fit the neat, sanitized version that everybody came here for religious freedom and everyone was happy to enjoy this great shining city on the hill.
We're speaking with Ken Davies, who is a historian and an author of a bunch of books called Don't Know Much About, the Bible, about the Revolution, about you pick it. He'll write you a book on what you don't know much about, and then you know a lot more about it. But we got a little spoiler alert. Okay. The spoiler alert is we're going to be talking about history. And for those of you who want to kind of continue in your misbelief that history is boring and it's got nothing to do, turn to another station because Ken's going to already has shown us that history doesn't have to be boring and it can teach us a lot about what's going on in the world today. So, but I want to do, because we'll go all over the place, but I want to do a little focusing since it is our celebration of Independence Day, July 4th. So how come we celebrate on July 4th?
Well, in fact, John Adams was quite certain we would celebrate July 2nd because that is the date on which the Congress in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress, meeting and discussing these very, very weighty subjects of whether or not to leave the Great Britain behind and declare independence. It was a big decision. It says this was not something to be taken lightly. But they actually voted for a resolution on July 2nd, and John Adams went back home that night, back to his boarding room, and he writes a lovely letter to his wonderful wife, Abigail. And these are among the great letters in American history, the exchange, the correspondence between John and Abigail Adams. And he writes back to her and says, "Today we'll go down in history. We'll celebrate this day as a great memorial of, with bonfires and church bells ringing and parades and illuminations," which was a sort of fireworks of its day. And he was just off by 2 days because it was 2 days later when the Congress votes on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, explaining the vote 2 days before and the reasons for it, that really became established almost immediately in the American imagination as the birth certificate of the United States of America.
Now, Ken, the story I've heard, so now I know more, and I learn a lot every day because I don't know much, so there's a lot for me to learn. But the story I heard was that the printer kind of put the wrong date on it.
That is not accurate.
Oh,
It was voted on that day and by the Congress. What we don't have is Jefferson's draft. You would think that somebody would have made sure to hold on to that. He, a couple of days later, made what he called a fair copy, written in his own hand. And I have seen it, and it gives me chills when I see it right here in New York. The New York Public Library has a copy of Jefferson's handwritten fair copy of the Declaration of Independence, which, by the way, includes the things that Congress took out, because Jefferson had written the document and had to sit for 2 days while these men, these other 55 men, there are 56 signers, these other 55 men debate what to keep and what to throw out. Most of it was minor word changes for the most part, but they left out something very important that Jefferson wanted to include.
Okay.
And that was a charge. You have any idea what it might be?
No.
That was a charge that the King of England was responsible for the slave trade and was preventing Americans from ending it, which was utter nonsense in a way. I mean, this is Jefferson. Right. Jefferson was a pretty good propagandist. Right. So he blamed the King of England for, well, this was cut out, and because there was not going to be any discussion of slavery in his document that talked about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By the way, the existing phrase had been pursuit of property, and they were very delicate about that word also, because property in most people's minds at that time meant slaves. So there was not going to be any reference to this subject and this issue. Jefferson later says it was in deference to the men who owned slaves as well as the men who made a great deal of money transporting them.
Well, and probably wouldn't have gotten it through.
It wouldn't have gotten through. 41 of 57 signers were slaveholders or had something to do with slavery. So
now, there was a committee that kind of put it together, didn't they? Put together the decoration?
That's correct. There was a committee that was assigned to do it, and that committee started with John Adams, and it included Benjamin Franklin, the oldest delegate, perhaps the most famous American at that time, very well known for his writings, his publications. He'd been to England. He was really the first American celebrity in many respects. It included two gentlemen from New York and Connecticut as well, Sherman and Livingston. And then Adams said, we need a Virginian because Virginia is so important. Adams also knew that he was seen as something of a radical from Massachusetts. So they wanted a Virginian because Virginia was influential and it would take the heat off of him. He knew Jefferson's writings. He didn't know him personally. He recommends Jefferson, says he's 10 times a better writer than I am, which is probably true, if he said it.
But not as many words as Adams. Adams never could write two sentences when one would do.
This is quite true, and he was a wordy gentleman. But some of those words, as I mentioned, the letters in particular, are really worth reading. So Jefferson is given the assignment, sets himself up on a portable desk that he had designed himself and had built for him by a Philadelphia carpenter. We could essentially call it the first laptop because that's what it was. He put it on his knees and drafted the Declaration on this portable desk, wooden desk. It's in the Smithsonian, and you can Google it and find Jefferson's desk at the Smithsonian. He writes it. Adams and Franklin make a few suggested changes. Franklin is often credited as being the one who says change life, liberty, and the pursuit of property to happiness. And I think we're all glad that he did. So there were some other suggested word changes. Then, as I mentioned, it goes to the full Congress for debate. And they pick over it for 2 days. And Jefferson was not a man who suffered fools gladly. He sat and fumed while they picked over his words.
Now, I've heard this story that that he complained to Franklin about that they were picking on his words. And I don't know where I picked it up, but that Ben Franklin says, oh, young Tom, be happy if you recognize a phrase when they get done with it.
Well, there's also an apocryphal story that he tells him about somebody who has a hat store and had a sign out in it, and it said, beautiful, magnificent, wonderful hats. And somebody comes along and says, no, you should take out beautiful. And then somebody else comes along and says, take out magnificent, take out the wonderful. And eventually it just says hats. So Franklin tried to tell Jefferson that's the nature of being edited. And as a writer, I can say, you know, we always think our words are perfect as we put them on the page, but sometimes an editor is a good idea.
All right.
And certainly in the case of Jefferson's Declaration, what we have is a magnificent document that has stood the test of time and has not been just an inspiration to America. It's been an inspiration to people around the world.
You know what I don't like about the way that we kind of deal with the Declaration of Independence is that, you know, probably if we did a little test, and probably a lot of people could tell you the beginning. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident.
In the course of human events,
right. You're right.
It becomes necessary for one nation.
Right. But what people fail to quote very often is the last paragraph, that we pledge our solidarity. And this is my bias, so you get mine. We so much call it Independence Day that it permits, at times, rampant individualism, uncaring about the common good, because we so have highlighted in this country the notion of freedom, the notion of me on my own, and we don't realize that Declaration of Independence from England was dependent upon the Pledge of Solidarity.
Completely, and it gets further enforced, without getting too much into constitutional history here, it gets further enforced 11 years later when some of those men and others come back to Philadelphia and draft the Constitution, which is about we the people in order to form a more perfect union. And after that, we also get the first official motto of America, which is, of course, E Pluribus Unum. Forgive my Latin. Out of the many, one.
Right.
And that's an idea that we have been struggling with for a very long time ever since. Here we are 230-odd years later and still struggling with the idea of the rugged individualist and the idea of a united nation, indivisible, as the Pledge of Allegiance, of course, says.
We're speaking with Ken Davies, a historian and author of Don't Know Much About. It's a history book series, and as I told you before, if you want to be bored and you think history's boring, turn to another station. We're not going to let history be boring. And right now, we're going to let Ken prove how much I don't know about history. So, Ken, ask me some of those Declaration of Independence, Independence Day questions, and I'll make our listeners feel really, really bright, because I won't know the answer to them.
Well, I've asked you one already, but it bears repeating, because I think many in the audience might know how many Catholics signed the Declaration of Independence.
Well, now I know that John Carroll of Carrollton was the only one. I'd guess six, but that was hedging my bets, but it's only one.
It is only one, and Carroll of Carrollton, very, very wealthy man, and actually lived the longest of all the signers, lived well into his 90s. Going back for a moment, because I want to touch on something you said about that last paragraph, that what they pledged actually was their sacred honor,
right,
their fortunes, and their lives. Right. And that's an important thing.
You mean taxes weren't a four-letter word for the founding fathers?
No, they pledged their fortunes to this idea. There has been a great deal of mythology about what happened to these 56 signers, that many of them suffered grievously because they signed this. And that is, unfortunately, mythology. I, right now on my website, which is don'tknowmuch.com, have a ongoing series about whatever became of the other 56 signers. So if anybody's interested in those men other than, you know, the four or five names you might remember, John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Ben Franklin, there are 52 other people who are quite fascinating. Okay, how many presidents, future presidents, signed the Declaration?
Five.
Oh, it's only two. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
Okay. All right, I got that wrong.
Okay. Here's a one I love, because this is relates to Philadelphia. You probably grew up learning about Betsy Ross designing the flag.
Right.
We know now that pretty much is a legend. One of the signers of the Declaration actually takes credit for designing the American flag as we know it, the Stars and Stripes. Any idea who designed the American flag that we know, signed the Declaration?
I don't have the slightest idea. Who did that?
Again, one of these fascinating characters, Francis Hopkinson, who was a poet, an attorney, a fascinating character. He was on one of the boards of the Congress after the war begins, and he, in fact, designs the flag. We have a piece of evidence because he submitted a bill to the Congress for in return for his services.
How much did he charge?
Well, this is the other interesting part. He asked for a quarter cask of the public wine. Now, I didn't even know we had the public wine.
Okay.
And Congress actually turns him down because they said he's already on the congressional payroll, so he wouldn't be double dipping. So one of the other interesting, fascinating signers. How many men sign the Declaration on the 4th of July? Of the 56 signers.
The people from New York didn't sign. So 56, I don't know, 48?
Actually, only two men sign on the 4th of July. John Hancock, who is the presiding officer, and Charles Thompson, who's the secretary. And because what they were signing was Jefferson's
draft. That's a trick question.
Draft. No, well, that's okay. They're all trick questions. What we think of as the, you know, the document with that big John Hancock in the center wasn't really signed until August because it had to be sent to a printer.
Right.
A printer had someone prepare a beautiful parchment version of the document. That's the one that got the big fancy signatures. Most, but not even all of the signers signed that document in August. And then the other document that's well known is something called the Dunlap Broadside, because once the parchment version was done, they gave it to a printer to create 200 copies that could be sent around to the country. I think we have about 27 of those Dunlap broadsides in existence. They're in mostly in academic libraries. Of course, the original parchment edition is the version is in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., in the fantastic hall of it's a shrine of wonderful documents that include the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Articles of Federation.
Okay, so come on, give me an easy question. Give me one I got at least a chance of getting right.
Okay, how about, let's see.
There were 13 original colonies.
There were 13.
I got one right.
There were 13 original colonies that became 13 original states.
Right.
What's the 14th? This is not a declaration.
Delaware?
No, Delaware is one of the original 13.
Texas.
Vermont.
Vermont.
Vermont becomes number 14.
Did it split off from New Hampshire? Is that what happened?
There was a lot of splitting off because New York claimed it, New Hampshire claimed it, and actually Ethan Allen, a really fascinating character from our early history, he wanted to set up an independent republic of Vermont, and it actually was for some time the independent republic of Vermont.
Okay.
He's important early in American history because he is the one in 1775 who takes the guns at Fort Ticonderoga. He's accompanied by a very, very, another famous American who's left out. Who was with Ethan Allen when he captured Fort Ticonderoga?
Benedict Arnold.
Perfect. You see, I knew you would get one of them.
He's the only guy I knew who was up in that part. Then he became a trader and he came down the Hudson Valley.
That's
and
right.
All of those type of things. So.
All of these questions, by the way, are fun and they're interesting, but it just proves how interesting these personalities and these people are. And I have another one for you. You're a New Yorker, right?
Yep.
Okay. Very famous road, prominent road in New York is named for one of New York's signers. What road would that be?
Livingston Manor Road.
Nope. Francis Lewis Boulevard. You've probably driven on the LIE and seen Francis Lewis was a very wealthy merchant, farmer-owned property on Long Island, and so he is one of the New York's signers.
Wow, I could go on forever. I could go on forever. Come back sometime, will you?
I would love to, and I would just want to mention the latest book. It's not a don't know much about book. It's called The Hidden History of America at War, and it begins with the history of how we have gone to war from the Revolution. The Battle of Yorktown is the centerpiece of that, right through Iraq. And it's really important because it discusses, like your next guest perhaps, who has fought for us, how we take care of them. And I think that's a very, very important subject.
Tell
for
our listeners the name of that again.
That is called The Hidden History of America at War. You can learn more about me and my books at don'tknowmuch.com. That's all one word. And I try and make that a place where I connect history to the headlines, the past and the present.
Ken Davis, who is a writer, a historian, and not boring. And so, Ken, thanks so much for being with us on Independence Day when we celebrate our history. And history isn't about the pages of the book. It's about the people, and it's about the lessons we learn and how we have to make our positive contribution to history. So, Ken Davies, thanks for being with us, and I'm going to learn more about.
Thank you, and now go pursue happiness.
Okay. Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Just Love. This is the Catholic Channel. Join us when we come back in 2 minutes, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is Independence Day week, the 4th of July week. We celebrate the history of these United States of America. We just spoke with Ken Davies, who is a historian and who has written a series of books called Don't Know Much About. And he's written, 10 of them, 12 of them, to help us learn about a lot of different things. And so we learned a little bit about history as we celebrate Independence Day. And but I want to talk just for a few minutes before we go to our next guest about something historical that's coming, and historical because I guess it doesn't happen too often. Pope Francis is coming to the United States. He's coming to the United States in September, and just this past week, they kind of talked about all the places that he's going to go when he comes here, and we're excited because he, in addition to the Pope coming to Philadelphia for that World Day of Families meeting, which is kind of the reason he's coming here, he's going to do a few day trips. He's going to do a day trip to New York before he goes to Philadelphia, and a day trip to Washington, D.C. before he goes to Philadelphia. He's not going to take Amtrak, but he's going to kind of hang out on the eastern seaboard of the United States, and we're really, really excited about that. And I got to share with you from my perspective at Catholic Charities, one of the reasons I am so excited is because Pope Francis, I think quite rightly, has gotten to be known for somebody who wants to make sure that the part of the Church's mission which deals with those who are on the margin, those who are poor, are not forgotten. And in so many different ways, as we've talked about on this show, he has gone out of his way to make sure that that is communicated, that the Church is a Church that cares for those who are on the margin, cares for those who are poor. Even him doing certain things in the square of St. Peter's, providing haircuts for people who are homeless, providing showers, is a way of communicating that the poor are part of the Church, that we are part of the Church, and they have a call on our attention, on our gaze, on our resources. And so that's why I'm particularly excited that on his trip to the United States, he's going to do two particular events with those whom are helped by Catholic Charities. When he's in Washington, D.C., he's going to be visiting one of the Catholic Charities programs that deal with homeless people and people who are hungry, to kind of show his support, his solidarity with those who don't have enough to eat, those who don't have a decent house. And he's going to spend some time with those people and to support those who are there. And I just think that's absolutely wonderful. I'm delighted that the Pope is going to address Congress. I think that is great. I'm glad that he is going to speak to the United Nations. I think that is wonderful. And I think it's good. He's celebrating Mass. That is wonderful. That's at the core, that the center of our Catholic faith, where we praise God, we listen to God's word. And that Pope Francis is going to do that with us in New York, he's going to do it with people in Washington, and then he's going to have a big Mass in Philadelphia. I think that's great. But I'm sharing with you a little bit of my kind of perspective and the thing that is really making me so very, very enthusiastic about his trip. And that is that he's gone out of his way to spend time not with the leaders of Congress, not to the leaders of the United Nations, not with all the people who will hang out in cathedrals and basilicas, as wonderful as all of that is. But he's going to take the time to be with those people who don't have enough to eat, those who have a decent home. And then when he comes to New York, he's going to be with those people who are newcomers to the United States, those who have come here to make a better life for themselves, their family, immigrants who have come here over time to make the United States their new home, and with refugees who come here because oftentimes where they have come from, there is persecution, there's violence, there is real danger that they might die if they don't leave where they are. And so when he's in New York, he's going to be visiting with refugees from Africa, from Iraq, from different parts of Central America. And again, to express his solidarity and the love of Jesus, that those who are persecuted, those who are in danger, they warrant the attention of God's people. They warrant the attention of the community of faith. And so I'm delighted with that. He's going to meet with some of the children who have been coming in tens and hundreds of thousands and arriving at the southern border of the United States in Texas, and then who are placed in different parts of the country, thousands of them in the New York metropolitan area. So a group of those children will have the opportunity to hear Pope Francis, to actually present him with a gift, to express their gratitude that he has come to be with them. We're going to have visiting with Pope Francis some of those men who are trying to support their families by lining up in the morning on the corners in various parts throughout the metropolitan area, trying to get a job for the day there, with whom Catholic Charities is making sure when they work that they get paid, making sure that the working conditions are decent. They know how to use the tools that they have. So the Pope is going to kind of be meeting with them and some of the mothers groups that come together to support each other in a difficult new home. So as you can tell, I'm enthused that Pope Francis is coming and that he's going to be meeting with those people whom it is really the blessing and the privilege that Catholic Charities is entrusted to serve and to care for. And that is such a really important part of his visit to these United States. And quite frankly, one of the things that is so great, as Pope Francis has spoken about the need for us to be concerned, the fact that in the United States, in so many places, there is just a wonderfully warm, professional, compassionate Catholic Charities that is the mission of the Church, to bring the good news of help and hope to so many of our troubled neighbors. And Pope Francis is going to affirm that when he comes to visit here. So I'm just absolutely delighted that when he's coming, and we're going to be talking about his visit a lot more in the upcoming months, but since it was just announced this past week, I just wanted to talk about that aspect of his coming. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with about veterans who are trying to make it when they come back from war. We'll speak with Jaspin Booth, who is the founder of Final Salute. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, Just Do It. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Come back in 2 minutes to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We speak with those people who try to make our world a better place. And we're going to be speaking on this during this Independence Day week with somebody who's doing precisely that. We're going to speak with Jaspin Booth, the founder of Final Salute. And Final Salute is a mission to provide homeless women veterans with safe and suitable housing. We're going to learn a little bit about what's going on with veterans who come back and from fighting. Jasmine herself was in Operation Iraq Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, and she's a Chicago native, and I'm delighted that she is with us. Jaspin, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. I truly appreciate the opportunity.
I am great. So, were you born in Chicago?
Yes, born and raised.
Great. Are you still hang out in Chicago, or are you someplace else now?
I actually live in Northern Virginia, which is close to D.C.
Okay, that is great. So, Jaspin, tell us a little bit about Final Salute.
Final Salute is an organization that I founded in November of 2010, and it was in response to the lack of supportive, safe, and adequate housing for homeless women veterans and their children. I myself noticed this inadequacies in 2005 when I experienced Hurricane Katrina and cancer within a month of each other, and through those significant events, I went to Social Services and Department of Veterans Affairs looking for services for women veterans and their children, but even in 2005, everything was still male-centric, and so I ended up with my young son sleeping on my aunt's couch.
So just give our listeners a little bit of kind of a sense of what we're talking about in terms of numbers. I mean, I know that probably most people are familiar with some of the debates about women in the military, about in combat, all of those things. But at the end of the day today, if you looked at those who are in the armed services, what's the percentage who are female?
Right now, for reference to women veterans, there are about 2 million women veterans who have served. Reference the homeless numbers, there is 55,000 homeless women veteran nationwide. So although the women make up a small percentage of the armed forces, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't receive the same service and support when they come back to serve, just as our brothers are given.
I mean, without a doubt, what you're saying is 100% on target. I was just trying to give our listeners a little bit of sense of the armed services now, just what's kind of the percentage that are female after kind of all these years of changes. So do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, we're about 18 to 20% of the force.
Okay. All right. So, it's certainly not close to half, but it's not like 1 or 2%. So it's a significant number of people who need certain services. And I can understand exactly what you're saying, that, you know, probably that 18% number has grown, and probably if we look back 25 years, it may have been under 10% or something. I'm just making that up. And I think what you're saying is that because the armed services were so predominantly male, that's the way the services were focused and not too women-friendly. Is that your experience?
That's correct, but I'm feeling that excuse is a bit outdated because we've been serving since the early 1900s. So to be an afterthought in 2005 in my situation, and still an afterthought in 2015, it's like, you know, when are we as Americans going to stop using the excuses? Hey, you haven't been in that long, where it's not that many of you. You know, when you're sending to us to Iraq and Afghanistan, we're coming back with PTSD, you know, wounds and other battle related injuries. You know, we need the same support, regardless if there is one of us or 20,000 of us.
Now, are there different types of services that women need than men need, or are they just the same that need to be available to women?
Yes, I mean, definitely as women and men, we have unique needs based on our anatomy. But, you know, also with the same experiences that we have in a battle situation to come back to America, you know, we all need you know, support for post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, then there's military sexual trauma thrown into that occasion. But what I found through my research and through my advocacy is over 70% of women who are homeless or facing homelessness, over 70% of them have children. And that's a statistic that far outweighs the men who need supportive services. So the housing that's set up, over 60% of the government funding programs can't even take in women with children. So what do you do with your children?
Now, there's a very specific issue, which seems to me to be so very clear that needs to be addressed. We're speaking with Jasmine Booth, who's the founder of Final Salute, whose mission is to try to help with housing needs for homeless women veterans. So, Jasmine, tell our listeners a little bit about what Final Salute is doing to try to deal with the difficulty or the scarcity of safe and suitable housing. What's Final Salute doing?
Well, obviously, as a small organization, but a more prominent organization, we obviously can't house the 55,000 that are out there homeless, but we heavily deal with also prevention of homelessness. People always say, hey, what do you want to do 20, 30 years down the road? And my thing is not to have, you know, 200, 300 houses across the U.S. It's to not have any homeless women veterans or veterans, period, you know, for that matter. So we're able to assist in prevention, which is the key to any homelessness. So that could be, you know, paying a couple of pass-through rents, helping them with a security deposit to get into their own place, help with utilities, things that happen, you know, as a part of life. You know, you lose a job, you're in between jobs, you know, you get less hours, things like that you can't plan for. So it's always a matter of the veteran making a bad decision that led them into that situation. But sometimes life happens and we're not always prepared for life to happen. So we're able to help them, you know, to get over those temporary humps.
Now, the issue of affordable housing for people in general and for women with children is a real problem in the urban areas and even the rural areas of the country in general. It's just not enough of it. Are there specific issues in finding the right kind of housing for women veterans that are different than those who have not been deployed?
Well, the biggest issue is that women veterans, although we're a small percentage of the armed forces, we're overrepresented in the homeless population, you know, as women. You know, so again, with that, you know, where are the services for these women who have served? And I do believe that, you know, every American should be taken care of. But I do believe that a special matter of attention should be taken to those who have gone and served and fought in our wars. But it seems like that only that type of attention where you're going towards affordable housing and things like that are still being geared toward supporting the men first and foremost, which is an issue. You know, we're having to lose our kids to the system, lose our kids to family members. You know, I deployed. I had to be without my son while I'm deployed. I shouldn't have to come back on American soil and be without my kid again because America forgot to think about me.
You know, what you mentioned is certainly a very, very difficult issue that needs to be dealt with. But it's been said recently that not merely women, but we're not even doing what we need to be doing for returning male vets in terms of making sure that they can get by in society. That also has been something that people have been working on and writing on, too.
Yeah, it's an issue across the board. But if you Google housing for homeless women veterans, probably the only five organizations might pop up. But if you Google housing supportive service for male veterans, there will be pages and pages and pages of organizations. So it's not only a matter of, you know, getting services, it's that there's just more available to men, even though I can't take care of everybody, but there should be a equal amount of services for each gender. You know, so we're not against our brothers. We're not saying take care of the men. We're saying take care of everybody equally, give them what they need, take care of their children as well.
So, Jasmine, if there were two or three things that we should be doing as a country in order to deal with the problem that you identified and have spoken about, so what are the two or three things we should be doing as a country in order to solve the problem?
I would definitely say, one, we need to, as a country, to recognize the services and sacrifices of our men and women as equal. You know, there's this big debate about women serving in combat. you know, and if they're able to serve in combat. I have friends who are amputees who are not infantrymen or rangers. You know, once you go into a combat zone, that whole theater is danger. It doesn't matter, you know, what your gender is. All that matters is the uniform you wear. So I think that's the first thing we have to do is recognize that service and sacrifice is equal to change the mindset that women are just as deserving. You know, and the second thing we have to do is when we're putting together these services for veterans, we need to be looking at, hey, what are the individual needs of male veterans and what are the individual needs of women veterans? And the most important of the individual need is ensure that if you're prepared to take care of women, you're prepared to take care of their children as well.
That seems to me to be one of the critical differences because, again, you mentioned it already, that probably the question, the issue of post-traumatic stress is something that affects both men and women. On the other hand, the reality in America is that if it is a single-parent family, the odds are that it's going to be the mom who's taking care of the kids, and that adds more complexity in terms of finding decent housing and in also having enough income to be able to support the kids and the family.
Correct. You nailed it.
And so, okay, those are two things. So what's your hope for Final Salute going forward? What would you like to be doing next year to kind of moving forward?
Well, next year, you know, and unfortunately the problem is not going to go away before next year. But again, although we are housing women, veterans, and their children, we would like to, you know, assist the country in aiding in the prevention of homelessness. You know, some veterans who are facing homelessness can't get help until they're actually homeless. You know, our veterans should not have to hit rock bottom in order for you to pay attention to them. You know, it costs a lot less to help them get over a rent hump than it is now to have them homeless on the street and now needing, you know, housing and all these other issues that come with, you know, being homeless. And so we need to continue to focus on prevention. And what helps is shows, you know, like you guys that are helping me and my sisters that don't have a voice to be able to voice the opinion and the disparities that are happening when it comes to taking care of veterans. So, again, I truly appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Jasmine, I'm delighted that you took the time to speak with us. And I think what you highlight is that with so many different populations, that there are little special understandings or special parts to an overall problem. So as we talked about before, the issue of finding affordable housing for people in general is really hard given how the high cost of housing in so many places. But then when you add the fact that somebody is a veteran that may have some post-traumatic stress issues that they're dealing with, then you add the fact that it might be a mom with kids, that makes it even more difficult to find the right home and or affordable place. So what you say at the beginning seems to me to be just something we have to put increased attention to is namely, let's prevent people who are in houses, in homes, in apartments from becoming homeless because that would make us at least be able to preserve that for those individuals who are there.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Hey, Jasmine, I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. And I just want to wish you the best of success on your work and in raising up the issue and making sure that, you know, we think about our women veterans and we don't realize that we don't forget their contribution to the country and that we realize the special needs that some of them may have with their children in housing. So, Jasmine Booth, founder of Final Salute, thanks so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity again. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, we do ask a lot of those people who go to support us, and it just seems to me so self-evident that when those individuals come back, we need to make sure that we take care of them. And I think that, you know, most veterans coming back, they don't want to be, you know, they won't be taken care of forever. They pretty much want an opportunity to be able to come back and to have the skills needed in order to be part of society, to get the job that they need and to get the training they need and to be able to pay their rent, to pay their mortgage. And I think that's a critically important thing that we do this. So, you know, We talked about history today, and history is critically important. We are a historical religion. We believe Jesus Christ came, was born here, and we believe that we work out our salvation, that we journey to God's kingdom working through this world. And the more we understand about this world, the more we understand about its history, our own nation, the better we then can understand how we bring the values of the gospel to lighten and to make real that world. So as we celebrate Independence Day, the pursuit of liberty, so many values that are also our Christian values, let's wish everybody a wonderful holiday. And join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM, Just Love, 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.